Kerry Adams, and you're listening to Kerry's Connoisseurs, coming to you from Solid Gold Podcasts. Here we talk to the movers and shakers, the drinkers, the dreamers, and all the people who make it happen in the liquor and luxury industries from around the world. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Kerry's Connoisseurs podcast. Today, I've got the crown jewels, I think, in my studio. But having said that, I better rephrase that. That could come across as offensive. Christo Larisch, guys. Christo Larisch doesn't really require too much introduction. He is here because yesterday I was privileged enough to be at a tasting of his 2021 vintage of the Reserve release, which was just astounding. So I enticed him into my studio today, and here he is. Welcome.
Thanks, Kerry. Lovely to be here.
So we have to look at that blue light every now and again so that everybody can see your big eyes. And for the rest, you and I are just going to look at each other. Christo is fourth generation. Seventh. What are you?
No,
lots
second.
Of generations.
Second generation in
of Larisch. I mean, the Larisch farm has been
No. My dad was the first winemaker since we sold our family farm in 1720 in Franschhoek. So we haven't been involved in winemaking for a very long
time.
For
as long as that.
No, we'd come out of the Kalahari. So we
I
were part
known.
Of the Kalahari National Park. My great-great-grandfather was still part of the negotiations with the then government to establish the park.
Oh, really?
And so, yeah, you can go all the way back, but there's Elias Larisch, who was my grandfather's cousin, was the head game ranger from 77 until 94 in the Kalahari.
Really?
And then before him, Joop Larisch was there from 1940 till 1977. And Joop was my grandfather's father, Martin Larisch. They were brothers. And then their father, or actually their grandfather, he was kind of not that loved by the English down in the Cape. So he kind of made his way up to where they couldn't
was
find him.
Was it that English-French thing still?
No, it wasn't the
English-French.
It was more of he was French, but it was more of an English. By that stage, we were so Dutch that we were kind of part of that more Afrikaans kind of mindset. And he had gone up to the Kalahari, and he had started a trading post. And they had started to trade with the San people who were in the region. And he had just grown in love with the people and the region and what the Kalahari was all about. And through that trading post and getting to know all the farmers in the area, they started to identify that this needs to become a kind of a national reserve. And so then in around the 1920s, they were very involved with negotiations with the government, and they helped to demarcate the whole Kalahari.
Wow.
And once the park was established, there was 60 years, so three generations of Larisches managing the park from there.
Wow. And have you ever had any burning desire to go and be a game ranger?
Actually, yes.
Be that park person.
When I was 9 years old, I wanted to go actually become a game ranger.
Oh, did you?
And then I quickly realized
that. I could be a game ranger.
It's an extremely romantic job to be involved in. But then I quickly realized that I won't be able to feed my family with it. So
you could eat the animals.
it's a little bit counterproductive.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And you're there to keep them alive, not to the other direction. So, no, I quickly realized that game raging wasn't for me. And then by about 14 years old, it was like, well, I love the outdoors. I love the sciences. I've got this amazing wine business that I can get involved in. So it was kind of a no-brainer from there to move into the wine industry.
So you were born in Franschhoek, or where?
Belleville Hospital.
Okay, well, we'll move
so
swiftly on.
We'll move swiftly on.
We'll forgive you for being born in Belleville Hospital.
No, but we were living at Rustenburg Estate at that stage.
That's right. Your dad was the winemaker. He was cellar master there.
Yeah, he was cellar master there. But no, so my mom went through to Belleville Hospital for the birth.
So born and bred on Rustenburg, I can think of worse places to be born.
It wasn't bad, I must say.
And worse families to have
quite amazing.
And the Barlows, just the nicest people.
No, it's amazing people.
Loving space.
Peter and Pamela Barlow were still in charge when my father moved in.
Yes.
So And then my dad worked for a long time under Pamela, which was also, I mean, she was such a lovely old lady. Mm. But surprisingly enough, my dad's, our English pointer, there was one person who couldn't come near the house, and that was Pamela. She did not like her.
Well, you must always trust a dog.
We got into trouble for that a little bit, but actually she was a dog person.
You must always trust a dog's know-how. You know, they know better than people. Maybe there was something about our Pam that we didn't know about.
No, I don't think so. She was a lovely lady.
She was lovely, but you never know.
And then the Jersey cows on the farm, which was obviously one of her big loves and passions, just walking around the farm, having the cows and... the sheep at that stage still were the Motleys. I still stay with the Motleys, and actually every year when we go up for the Winemaker Surf Classic in Jongensfontein. So okay. They retired out in Jongensfontein. So okay. We're still in contact with them. Charles Withington, who owns the Darling Wine Shop.
I remember Charles so well. He used to come and visit me at Norman Goodfellow. He's also such a nice man.
Yeah, so it was this beautiful community of people. Kevin Watt, who's now a viticulturist still in Stellenbosch.
Fabulous viticulturist.
So I've got so many good memories. And just like growing up on the farm, running around, I still remember breaking the cow stable's gate when me and one of my best friends were swinging on the gate when we were 7 years old. So we got into a lot of mischief.
If only kids could still have that kind of upbringing, hey?
You still get that growing up in the farms. And I think that's the beauty of winemaking is, we get winemaker salaries and we'll never – it's tough to own the farms in Stellenbosch. But you've got this lifestyle of this incredible lifestyle you grow up with. You meet amazing people throughout the world. Mm. And you're living in this beautiful surroundings of the Cape Winelands.
I know.
So it's really an unbelievable career to be involved in.
I've traveled to a lot of the wine regions of the world, and the Western Cape really, really is up there with the best of them. Mm-hmm. Hey? I think maybe the Mosel might be more beautiful.
I haven't
been
there.
If you go down the river and there's huge castles up the river banks, and I mean, it's like fairyland.
But Piedmont is just as spectacular.
No, listen.
So there's a lot of beautiful spaces out there.
We're in love with wineland, so they're all gorgeous. But
I know, but we've got the oceans, we've got the mountains, we've got Cape Town.
Western Cape is very beautiful.
It's a nice place, except we've got the wind as well, which is a little bit unpleasant.
I know
that
wind. It's the one reason that I can't do Cape Town. I hate the wind. But for the rest, anybody who's never been to the Cape Winelands, make a plan, you're missing out. So your father has to go down in the annals of time, in the world of wine, as one of the people most sensitive to Cabernet Sauvignon. He's a Cabernet whisperer. Mm. He is like the cab whisperer. He makes the best Cabernet in the country, and certainly in many parts of the world, he makes the best Cabernet. And he's sort of whispered it to you somehow along the line, because I tasted a sensational 21 vintage yesterday, and it's just got that Larish cellar stamp on it. You can smell that Larish recipe. You just can. It's Larish magic. Mm. Your father bought his farm in the Yonkers Hook, okay?
No, we rented in the Yonkers Hook.
Did you rent in the Yonkers Hook?
My dad was a winemaker. Tell us the story. Come 1995, my dad had been at Rustenburg for 21 years at that stage. Mm. And it was an amazing start and kickoff to his career. But he had come to a point where he wanted to move on and kind of pursue his own direction. And it was funny. He came and he sat us down the one evening and he was like, right, we've got three options. And he was like, we're either moving to Canada, where there was a big job in Ontario that was offered.
You can make ice wine, maybe some more ice wine and some more ice wine.
I've got no idea what we would have done then.
And dive
probably
boredom.
I would probably have been in sailing and
you'd have died of boredom.
I'm very, very glad we didn't do that move. Or he would have taken the position at Del Air, which was one of the other options.
Or, could have been worse.
Which was also a lovely estate, and that would have been also a great move. Or he can take the risk and go out on his own. And fortunately, he decided to go out on his own, and it really worked for us. So he found a little cellar in the Yonkers Hook Valley.
I didn't realize he leased that. I thought that he'd bought that.
Okay. No, so he leased that. And the cellar was last in production in 1966. So when we moved in, it was a tractor store. It was dusty. The concrete tanks had to be relined and kind of cleaned up. The open top fermenters at the back were used for storage, and at some stage, I think they had stored some pigs in there. So, from a hygiene point of view, they all were epoxy lined. So we just make sure that none of that that's in the concrete actually can get into the wine.
Not too much wrong with a pig, though. We're fine with pigs.
I like eating them. I don't want to smell them in my wine. It's just one of those. I can do Forest Floor and Pinot Noir, but I can't do pigs.
Even that at a push. Yeah.
So we cleaned up the little cellar. We were renting from Kubis Marais then, and the Marais are actually still on the farm, sixth generation.
Are they?
They've been there for a very, very long time. And yeah, that's actually where Thistle and Weed are based now.
Oh, okay.
Yes, so the
that's a nice
and
one.
Sridhira moved in after us.
Teddy's
ex-wife.
Ex-wife, yeah.
Yes. So the that little cellar was just this beautiful small space. But we by 2010 we had kind of grown out of that cellar. There were only 5 open tops in there. We didn't have any more barrel room left. And the biggest issue with the cellar was that there were 4 big 15,000 liter tanks. And
probably
no other
why
tanks.
The wine was so nice.
Yeah, so my dad had to, at that stage, he used to buy the vineyards in and blend everything coming into just after harvest. So he would ferment the wine, taste it, and he'd be like, right, that's my reserve, that's my Cabernet, that's the Richesse. And that was all pumped into one tank. And that was it for
so it was
for the
quite limiting
season.
Really to
so, yeah,
they, establish you, the wine that you really
couldn't
wanted
really
to
nitpick as to the quality of individual vineyards. It was all based on gut feel and what he saw in the vineyards and what he tasted during
which
the
makes the quality of those old Lariches even more alarming.
No, it's a spectacular. And how my
if you
father
think of it.
He's just had a knack for walking to a vineyard, and he's always said, and this is something I've also taken from there. So when we walk into a new vineyard and we're trying to find something in the different wards and regions in Stellenbosch, yeah. It's always looking for a vineyard that's in balance. And you can walk into a vineyard and you immediately know, listen, this is possibly a great vineyard or not. I'm kind of biased. If I can see the sea, I'm happy. And then that means that this is probably going to be a nice vineyard. Mm. So in general, most of my vineyards actually have got a sea view over them, which also means that if you can see the sea breeze is going to hit you at some
stage. You can taste and smell it.
But it's also got an element to do with how is the vine in balance, how much vigor is there. If Cabernet has too much growth, it's horrible. Mm. It just doesn't work.
It goes green and leafy.
Exactly.
Just like the vine.
And it takes so much work to get it into balance. It's just not worth it in the end of the day.
But that's the trick, really, if you think of it in life. It's all about balance, really, isn't it?
That's true.
It's all balance.
It's very deep and philosophical.
we do true. Get deep on this program. Every now and again, we get deep. So you can get as deep as you like, Christo. I won't tease you. So you moved from Jonkershoek to where?
Yeah, so we moved from Jonkershoek to Raithby. So in 2010, we bought a 3-hectare small holding.
Where's Raithby?
Raithby is a little town next to Stellenbosch, between Stellenbosch and Somerset West.
Which well,
most people don't
else
know
about
it there. No, luckily not. So if you actually, if you turn off at Ken Forrester, mm-hmm. and you drive down the Winery Road, you get the 96 Winery Road restaurant that Ken owns.
I've seen a sign there that says Raithby.
And right behind the restaurant, there's a little town community. We've got a little corner shop cafe.
So is that where your place is?
Yeah. We're right next door to Post House and Anvilka.
I know exactly.
Foothills Vineyards, Lindgrove Estate. They're all sitting there around us. And what's beautiful is you just turn off the highway and it's dead, dead quiet. We're on a dead end road, a small little property. We've got about 1.3 hectares of Cabernet that we planted a year ago. Or 2 years ago, so it's still young fruit. So maybe I'll do a estate cab in about 10 years from now.
Real estate cab.
Real estate cab. It'll be the Lariche Estate Cabernet Sauvignon. That I'm already dreaming of.
I want the first bottle.
We can talk about that. but that move actually brought us closer to our main source of fruit. So we've always been working about 60% of the reserves coming from the Helderberg Coastal or that lower Helderberg area. And it's a difficult region to kind of wrap your mind around because there's very few producers who make a pure expression of it. The Graeme Beck...
What was it called?
That was the gravel... No, Coffee Stone. The Coffee Stone Cab.
Coffee Stone Cab, I think.
Was, I think, one of the best examples of what that region tastes like. The old J.P. Riddell wines are also from around there. So there's some beautiful wines. The first Neil Ellis's actually came off on Volca. 1983.
I'm a big fan of Ann Wilker. Those boys who bought that farm know exactly what they're doing.
it's a spectacular farm.
They've got a pedigree 5,000 miles long as well, and they knew exactly. That little space where you are is, you know, I've got this thing that I think we need to make a little power group about. Everybody talks about, you know, Napa and Sonoma is fabulous and Super Tuscans and First Growths and this and that. Everyone producing region has got something. Mm. I think that we have to establish something called Super Stellenbosch.
Well, why don't we just call it Stellenbosch?
It's just Super Stellenbosch, like a Super Tuscan. It's a Super Stellenbosch because there's Stellenbosch and there's Stellenbosch.
Mm.
Same as there's Tuscany and there's Tuscany.
Yeah.
So there are Super Stellenbosches and they come from specific little pockets of places.
Mm.
And it really does produce some of the best fruit in the world. It just does.
Mm. No, it's definitely there. And we, with Stellenbosch Cabernet, we are busy. And the Stellenbosch wine routes, we've really started working the last 5 years to identify awards, regions, what are the flavor profiles coming from each of the wine, each of the mountains and each of the wards. And doing that drill down of what makes the different components of Stellenbosch so unique.
On that note, this is where we can tell everybody about your Cab Reserve, because from what I can gather, you have really, really honed in on that.
Mm.
And you go in search of specific vineyards. And from what I gather, when you vinify, you put them into specific tanks or barrels. Mm. And then those are the components that make up the reserve. Mm. Am I right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So let's tell them, how many of those components have we got? Where does the big engine and gearbox for the reserve come from?
So
my phone's supposed to be switched off. I'm sorry. Oh, my God. Sorry. Sorry, Callum.
So the basically my gearbox is between Wraithby and Firgrove. I've got one farm out in Firgrove where we've been working with them since 1998, Chris Stain. And he's now been, actually his daughter's just taken over, which I'm very, very excited about.
That's one of my favorite fruit places.
Mm. No, the fruit
from the fruit bowl. That's the best part of the fruit bowl.
It's spectacular, and it's mainly grape growers in the area. So you can get a couple of, I think Bernard Bredell is one of the guys who's really trying to champion the region. I know Jocelyn Hogan's Divergent is coming from the Cab Franc, Cab and Cinsault are all coming from blocks that I share with her.
Are they?
So that's another great example.
She's making nice wine.
It's beautiful wines that she's making. Mm. So there's Peter Valso does quite a few wines from around there as well. Obviously working with all the fruit in the region.
Mm.
So there's some beautiful examples.
So that's your big gearbox.
So that's my gearbox. And then we always were in the Yonkershoek, but I think 2022 we've moved out of Yonkershoek fully. I'll be going back in again, but we're busy replanting vineyards.
Did you replant? A virus, a little bit virus thing?
That block, it was a virus thing, but it's also the old thing of Marcus Yoster and everything around there, which we don't want to go into too much detail in. But the farm was sold.
Nice to have a gangster wine every now and again.
It's quite cool.
Let's have a gangster wine.
A little bit of spice to it. But I don't want to tell people because otherwise they'd stop buying my wine. Yeah. There's quite a few people who are not very happy about Steinhoff. But in any case, that farm was sold. There's new ownership that's come in, and they wanted to kind of revamp the whole space. So the vineyard was pulled out. But I'm working there with Warren Ellis about doing replantings on that site.
Is he sharing with you?
No, not from Clan Gastro, unfortunately.
Coming from a father who was the original cuckoo winemaker, he used to go and lay eggs in everybody else's cellar. He was the original cuckoo winemaker.
He was. He was one of the first ones to went out on his own.
He was.
Look at how long was he at Star Condé renting
up
there.
I know.
From Odin Nectar. And, well, now they've got their own space. So now he had to make his own nest. So.
Yeah, yeah.
There's just not a lot of space available in Yonkershoek to buy from.
Yes.
So we've got our sites, but with the vineyard being pulled out, we need to replant. So there's about about 10 years, but we've known this coming for about 10 years. So I've shifted over onto the Simmelsberg Mountain. So we're getting there from around three blocks that we're working with. And then I've actually recently, in the last 5 years, we've started pulling in Upper Helderberg. So that's the Helderberg North region.
Above Botlere.
On the Helderberg.
Helderberg by Boschendalisch.
So above the R44. So Rustenburg, Ernie Els.
I'm so bad with where areas. I am in Cape Town. I stay in Joburg and sell it.
So not by Boschendal, but Boschendal's actually just taken over 150 hectares on the Helderberg, which is also quite interesting. They stole one of my vineyards, so I'm still not very happy about them.
You've got to watch Tim Hutchinson.
I know, they're very sneaky. They come in, you suddenly hear rumors, and they've taken it over.
You've got to wake up early in the morning to be smarter than Tim Hutch. Yeah.
But it's for me, part of the, it's actually very exciting. Because you're seeing farms where the farms were really struggling.
Yes.
The vineyards were struggling. There was a lot of virus around. And the families who were farming them just didn't have the capital to replant the entire
farm.
And
it's expensive.
It's extremely expensive.
I mean, everybody thinks there's this dream. There's this wonderful romance around a wine farm.
Mm.
And we can see why. It's just exquisite.
Mm.
Who doesn't want to wake up in the Western Cape on a Monday morning and have those mountains as your backdrop to your office? I mean, who doesn't want that? But it's very expensive.
It's very expensive.
It is.
But what Boschel have done, they've actually got long-term leases on these farms. Mm. So the farmers are still owning their land.
Good.
But they know that the whole farm's being farmed basically on a rental system.
And that's good, because you don't want to erode heritage. Heritage plays an enormous part in the intrinsic value of any wine.
Mm.
So we know that. So that's a good thing.
And now at least all those virus vines are gone. We lost a couple of heritage vineyards, but it was kind of necessary as well.
Sometimes when you get too old, you have to be put up to pasture. Will you boys do that to me? When
you
say, Carrie's too bloody old.
You're still very far away from that.
We're going to send it. We're going to put it on one of our farms and tell it to shut up.
I don't think that's going to happen. So we've moved up into the Helderberg. I was just feeling that there's a component of it brings such a lovely broad tannin structure.
Yes.
Big, powerful tannins, lovely, savory black fruit, olive tapenade, if you don't go too ripe on the wines. And it's an important component.
So those slopes? North-facing slopes.
North-facing slopes.
Yeah.
Warmer slopes. And you've got this band between 150 to 400 meters where Cabernet really performs.
Excels, yeah.
And then once you go over 400, you start to get a little bit more red fruit coming on the cabs.
And it gets a bit colder. And
it's a little
gets
bit cooler.
It's a bit like this. Does David Nivert's Five Generations have some cold climate cabinet? Because it's very fresh and very sort of restrained.
It does, but he also goes quite ripe on them. So you get that beautiful black fruited kind of character that does come in. I mean, he does a very, very good example of it.
No, he does.
But he's also got the ability up where he is that he can ripen for so long. He doesn't have virus. So everything just runs and ripens really well. But once you go over that 400-meter belt, then suddenly you start thinking, okay, Uvamira. Chardonnay.
Mm.
And then the high altitude Chardonnay in Stellenbosch starts to kick in. So it's just amazing to see how with that temperature flow going up the mountain and the way in which air moves up and down the mountain slopes, it completely changes where we work, how we work. And even though you might be turning towards the north from an aspect point of view, there's still sea breeze coming in and there's still this diurnal shift maritime climate coming in that you're making Chardonnays with amazing acidities in some way where you wouldn't really put the connection there.
Where are you making your shard from?
Our shard's coming from the Pulkadry and Firgrove.
Do you know that Pulkadry? That Pulkadry area, I'm very rude about it because it's not the prettiest place on planet Earth.
No, well, it's the best wine region in Kraaifontein.
I love the Torren Boys.
Pulkadry
is ugly. There's pylons, there's electrical pylons that run through the thing, and it's just not a pretty place. I mean, let's be honest.
If you turn towards the mountains, it's very pretty.
Listen, you boys are all very rude about where I come from. And I think they're parts of Joburg that's very pretty. I'm going to be rude about the polka dryer. It's fucking ugly. It's what my granny would have called fugly. It is fugly. So it might be, but
it's very
it's
exciting
at the
moment.
It's got the best soils. Ready hairs. You can make this
amazing
some very
soils.
Smart wine best. Coming out of there. Maybe I'm not gonna, best, I'm, but there, of the best.
There's a couple of guys there who will now be quite mad at me about that. But I think there are amazing soils. But what the Pulkadry is it's marginal. especially with Cabernet. And there's vintages where they are unbelievable, and then there's vintages where they just struggle to ripen their cabs. And that point of kind of that bottom end of ripeness is actually beautiful, especially in Cabernet. That's what Bordeaux is.
I just
Bordeaux
about to
in
say,
a bad vintage is undrinkable.
Polka Dry is like Bordeaux, which is why Bordeaux's prices are governed. They're vintage specific.
Exactly.
Which is what ours should be. Ours should be vintage specific. I don't mind selling a client a Larish cab for 2,500 rand a bottle for the 2021 vintage, and maybe 1,000 rand for the 2002 vintage.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Just off the top of my head, we should be more vintage specific because it's farming.
And
where you say it's marginal like that, it absolutely is. And that's exactly what Bordeaux and Polka Dry is exactly. It's almost marshy. It's like, I think it might even be like reclaimed seabed.
It depends on where one moves. If once you go over the hill, say on Donny Carinus' farm, his bottom lying areas are actually pure sand. Because you're
like
coming
beach.
Up from the Cape Flats where it's pure beach.
It's beach.
But as you move up that hill, you start to move over into the oak leaf soil. So then you get to Turin and Reineke. Also the slopes of Curribib where Duncan and those guys have worked. And if you ask Duncan, he knows about the clay on those farms because half his vineyard slid down the hill the year last year. So as you move up that slope, you go from these pure sands to coffee stone duplex to lovely rich clay soils. And if you can get the right aspect and you can get the right pockets, there's some beautiful, beautiful Cabernet vineyards.
Yeah, big time.
But in general, it's Chenin and Chardonnay country and Cabernet Franc as well. There's some beautiful examples of there. If you ask Brouwer, he's focused in and zoomed in on those areas.
I like that bit along where Cordoba is. Is like a Cab Franc street.
Yes, but that's on
my Cab Franc bit.
Yeah, but that's
like
the southern tip.
Burgish.
That's the southern tip of Helderberg. They've got that coolness coming in.
Oh.
But there's for me more power in that section on the Cabernet Francs, where there's more of that spice and herbaceousness and acidity coming out of the Polka Dry.
Yeah,
and it's that juxtaposed between the two ends in the end, and it's that's why there's these little microcosms and pockets. If you look at the Helderberg with Cabernet, that northern exposure, they don't really have bad vintages there. And
not really.
The Simmelsberg, a little bit more red fruited, very linear tannin, but. The Cabernet is, it on its own in a pure example, is a little bit more difficult.
It's but a bit acidic moment, for me. I don't want my Cabernet to appear acidic.
But the
acidic.
Moment you add a touch of Merlot and Cabernet Franc, the wines develop. So you see on the Simmelsberg, you see Cabernet much more blended in with Bordeaux style blends, where the Helderberg gets that
big,
luscious
ripeness.
Well,
it's sort of our left bank, right bank, isn't it?
No, exactly. And those two big mountains and the aspects and how those things change. Firgrove is actually where we get a vineyard that year on year has been performing as one of our best, which is our Stainsrist vineyard, Cabernet vineyard. And that vineyard had made up 30 to 40% of our reserve. We unfortunately had to pull that one out this year, but I've already got a second vineyard that's now
Doesn't
9 years old.
Doesn't break your heart to pull
it's
those
horrible.
Out?
It's horrible.
Do you have to pull everything out?
Yes, unfortunately.
Can't you just leave the odd sort of lone
The problem
vine?
Was that you've got, that vineyard was sitting at about 80% leaf roll virus.
Was right? it?
So,
and you taste it in the wine.
You can start to taste it. So last year we actually picked virus versus we picked on color and just looking at the berry itself because once virus really kicks in, you get these pink berries that come through, and it's basically
it
only good
so
for rosé.
It
and looks
the virus
pretty, but it's
makes
not what
the
Cabernet
vine
needs
look
to be.
Gorgeous in the autumn time. They turn red and gold and beautiful. Everybody thinks it's beautiful.
But
the bunches of grapes look prettier.
We
they
really
look
need
like
to be crying about it. So it's one of those things. We've been doing major strides in the industry for it. We've got a couple of guys who have got unbelievable research around it. I mean, Jaco Egelbrecht and Etienne de Blanche and Vinpro, the work they've been doing, the research up here in Johannesburg, actually, there's been a lot of research done on leaf roll virus.
We're quite clever in Johannesburg.
I know. You guys can think a little bit every now and then. especially when you decide to move down to Cape Town. It's good ideas.
So the work that's been done
is amazing.
You've got basically, how many vineyards in different barrels in your cellar that you can choose your menu from?
So,
for your reserve.
2024 vintage, I had 14 producers, 24 vineyards, 32 batches, and about 42 different components, because every batch we'll split into three. We've got a press component, a drainage component, and a free run component. So
the permutations are massive. So you spend
really
how long blending?
it's
63 blending, weeks blending your wine.
We're at the moment busy with 2023, and we did our first round in January. Second round, end of March. We've done another round in April. We've now got it nailed down to about two, maybe three wines that we're looking at.
I want to come for one of them.
Yeah, you can definitely come and pop in.
Phone me and I'll stick my head in.
So it's always April,
thing.
May in that period.
I always remember sitting one day tasting with Michel Roland in France. Was putting together a final blend for one of the producers. And I've never in my life been in the presence of quite such a nose and palate. Unbelievable, man. Completely unharnessable, untrainable, wild character.
Yeah.
But an olfactory memory that honestly is quite magical. It's like it's like an alien person. He's got such a good palate and such a good nose.
There's a few people I've met in my life who've been able to do that, and they're sitting in a tasting, they're busy blending. Michel is one of those, and just listening to winemakers who've worked with him, where
unbelievable.
He'll sit down, taste through the wines, he's like, we need
5%,
1% of fresh juice in this, and he'll take the 1%, add into the blend, and poof, suddenly
and
the whole thing pops.
And he doesn't even write anything down.
Yeah.
It's all here, as I say, in that olfactory memory. It's quite remarkable.
And there's been one guy in South Africa who I've met who had that level of skill, and that's a guy called Tinus van Niekerk. I don't know if you've come across him, but he used to be the master brain behind the Olivebrook range that Spa used to do.
Ah, that's quite right.
And Tinus is based up, he's got two PhDs. He consults for wineries in France. He did his one PhD on sensorial work from Bordeaux University. And he flies under the radar in the South African industry. But
nobody will understand it, really.
No,
and if they do, they'll tell him to bugger up.
We sat down with him blending for over about an eight-year period, and just watching him put together a five-way Bordeaux-style blend. And just sitting, and you can see his mind just go, taste through the wines, his mind just go tick, 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 tick. And he's like, okay, let's do that. Taste it. That's not right. We need to add a little bit more of this. And boom, he nails it every single time.
And I'll tell you why. The other thing is that it sounds awful, but you do need to have a very comprehensive understanding of retail and what people actually want to drink.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the big trick. That's the big, big, big trick. You know, you need to know what people want to drink. But anyway, that's aside the point. We digress. So you have got a massive, massive, massive amount to choose from.
Yeah.
To put your reserve together. And on average, how many cases of reserve do you bottle in a year?
So we at the moment sitting around 12,000 bottles. So that's about 2,000 cases of six.
It's not a huge amount.
No, it's not. I wish I could do more. Hopefully we will go into the future. We've been working really hard to get the vineyards in place to be able to make more. But it's one of those wines where it's so vintage dependent. In 2019, we made 5,000 bottles. In 2020, I made 13,000 bottles. And it's purely just based on how the vineyards performed, what the options were that we had, and then looking through the blends, tasting and evaluating where we find that optimal kind of blend that works in the end is what will determine the volume that we have. So I go into a vintage having no idea how much reserve we can produce.
Yeah.
And it's really dependent.
And you produce one every year?
We make one every year. So for us, it's about making the best possible wine that we can make in that vintage. And what you generally see is that vintages that are a little bit more tricky, the volume comes down. And great vintages like 2017, it was like, well, there's so many options, we can just put it all together. And vintage will determine and dictate how much fruit we have to work with. And it's all about what the vineyards come in. And when we talk about blending, we blend with Cabernet only. It's 100% Cabernet, and that's for us really important. Both the cabs that we do are 100%. We haven't added a splash of anything else over the years because it's trying to find that expression of Stellenbosch where we want to showcase the whole of Stellenbosch. It's not a single vineyard site terroir-driven wine. It is terroir-driven, but it's the terroir of Stellenbosch we're trying to showcase. Mm. And if you want to taste the individual components, come walk with me to
you
the cellar.
Yeah.
They're all in my barrels.
Yeah.
But they're not... It's when you taste my reserve, you've got to understand that this is about showcasing very best interpretation of Stellenbosch for that season, because Stellenbosch and Cabernet are so intertwined, and that's what we want to showcase in there.
And I think there's nowhere to actually research it other than in my head. And I think that my memory is telling me I keep a score, because Lariche has just been one of my favorite wines for many, many years in South Africa. And I think that the Lariche Cabernet and or Reserve is the most highly awarded cab in the country. I think it's had more Platter 5 stars, high points from people around the world. I think it is the most awarded Cabernet in the country. I'll check it out, guys, and I'll make sure, and I'll let you know. I don't want to give you false information, but I think it is.
I think it's going to be close on between us, Buchanan's Kloof. They've got a lot of 5 stars, and then there was
I don't think that they even enter their stuff anywhere too much anymore. Mark Kent is lucky, doesn't give it them.
And then there was obviously that period where Neil Ellis and Stark Conde were flipping out around the Three Pines Vineyard.
Mm.
So maybe not as many 5 stars on each of the individual wines, but that vineyard delivered 5 star on 5 star on 5 star.
I want that vineyard
which
before
is amazing.
I die.
Who owns that vineyard now?
Still, it's Stark Conde.
Yeah. So there's a couple of those just magic vineyards to Stellenbosch. If you think it's the Peter Barlow block up on Langs, where Langs won at the very top of Rustenburg. It's the Three Pines vineyard. It's our Stainsrist vineyard, which we've been working with so many years.
Mm.
There's a couple of these little gems throughout the industry where they just showcase so beautifully. Thelema, the mint block,
yeah, is absolutely beautiful. And then there's another one that, what's his name from De Toren has?
Emil. Oh, no, not Emil. Sorry.
No, Aubrey. What's his name? Why am I being so silly? Who's the MD Albie. Of Albie?
Yes.
He's got a cab vineyard on that farm somewhere that he uses.
There's one just above with Reinecke as well, where their Reinecke Reserve comes from. So there's these little pockets of Cabernets that can stand up as single vineyards on a year-to-year basis, which are spectacular.
And we wonder what... We wonder, before we started recording, Krista and I were just saying that sadly, contrary to popular belief, winemaking is really a combination of maths and art. And it's only the people who can do both. And there are not many people who've got a left and a right brain that are trainable. Mm. You know, you've either got one or the other. And there seems to be a streak that runs through the Lariche family that affords you the ability to do both. You've got highly intelligent wine that is so seductive and so delicious. You just want to drink it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I cannot explain to you what that 2021 vintage tastes like. I tasted it yesterday. It is just one of the nicest wines I've ever tasted in South Africa. Are you happy with it? I mean, it's just bloody gorgeous.
And I think
the 2022 is also ordinary cab.
Yeah.
Is also completely different. So 22 must have been a really good vintage for you as well.
I like 22. They're these lovely, voluptuous wines.
Yeah.
There's beautiful fruit components on it.
Yes.
They don't have the tannin structure and the acidity of 21.
No.
But it makes them accessible. And that's kind
of earlier
approachable.
Well, they're more for drinking now.
Exactly. So,
and it's like putting a big... I can't even explain to you guys. It's like putting a big mouthful of red and black suede into your mouth. Mm. You know what I mean? It's got those gorgeous, soft suede tannins and beautiful, rich, juicy fruit. It's like biting into the juiciest strawberries and blackberries and mulberries and all those things that we love in Cab. It's delicious. You have to have some. But I don't think you've got lots, have you?
Of the 21?
Yeah.
No, unfortunately
you
not. We're coming off the back of the 2020 Reserve, which... we were just flabbergasted by how well that
went. No, it was gorgeous.
The 2020 on an international scale, I've never seen another Cabernet in this country go in that direction, where we got the 99 with Tim Atkin, we got the Decanter Best in Show, 97.
Yeah, and, you got Spectator, also rated it somewhere, didn't they?
Robert Parker gave it a 98 as well.
98 or something, yeah.
So, I mean, that's basically, we've just tipped off the three biggest awards that there are internationally for South African wine.
No.
With one wine walking out there. So that wine walked out the cellar within 2 months. And it was actually, we were like, well, this is a bigger volume. We might have a little bit more wine to be able to sell. And it disappeared.
But it's like manna from heaven. You can all breathe. You can pay school fees.
I'm not going to complain about it. It's absolutely amazing. But it does give you the issue of like, well, now there's suddenly this demand which you've got to meet and you've got to manage. And the 21 is we're releasing it out on the 1st of June, but it's already allocated out.
I spoke to Heather yesterday. She said to me, I don't even know how much we're going to get.
So there's a very small amount. Our members are going to be getting their emails next week, so they'll get their allocations. Vinnie Mark has got its allocation, so there'll be a small volume.
And
that
do
goes
you frantically rush
train.
Back to your study and say, let me try and see what recipe it was that I did last year that made this thing, this magic happen?
No, look, we obviously every time we start blending, I look at the two previous vintages. We see at what works. I've always try and make one of the blends that when we start out, I always make five different blends. And the first one I make is a replica of the previous year. And it's very seldom that the replica is repeated.
Oh, really?
Most of the time I'm tweaking the blend to other direction. So it does, it's funny, like the 19 reserve had 32% Helderberg, upper Helderberg fruit. The 2020 had 10%. So it completely flipped around. And I tried it the other way around. It didn't work. The fruit just didn't sit in the blend. It didn't show up.
But you become so familiar. It's like one of your children. You know them from soup to nuts. You know them. So you know what you need to do to your babies to make them prettiest. You know how you do.
And you also know what's like if we taste through the blends, we'll have two wines. We'll be like, this is a beautiful wine, but it doesn't have the Larish signature on it. Where the other blend has the Larish signature on it.
And it's very important. I think that consistency is something that is just, if you look at all the great wines of the world, and please God, you get to the point where you are like one of the first growths, where you are producing a lot of wine from tiny properties. That's what you need to do. And that's what I love about you. Because your family has consistently driven a horse that says we want to produce the top quality Cabernet and lots of it, so it's for everybody. Because I don't think anybody really knows. I suppose we could get the answers if we asked nicely how much wine is produced at Lafitte and Latour and all of those things.
It's easy to make if they've got 100 hectares.
Nobody's ever said no to me. If I've phoned and asked for some, they've always said, of course we'll send you some, Kerry. You know, it's nothing
always scarce,
like,
but it's never sold out.
Never.
That's a champagne
recipe. And it's a very, very smart marketing tool. We need to learn from the French, and I think that you and your father are doing it really well. But
I wish I had more to sell. we'll get there.
How many hectares do you farm in total to put your reserve together?
So we've got about 16 hectares in the portfolio of vineyards that we're working with that is coming in from.
And on your own property where you all live, you've got two?
1.3 hectares, which is now 2 years old. So it's a minute. Once those vineyards are older, they'll probably be able to make up about 10% of our production. But I'm only expecting from half of that, which will be at reserve quality. The other component, the soils are just not there to. If I can get them there, I'll be absolutely amazed.
Just keep feeding them.
I will.
Just
feed them enormously.
That's going to be like your rose garden.
The one section looks like a beach. It's literally pure sand. It's 2 meters deep.
You'll be surprised what comes off the beach.
No, so we've now taken a regenerative approach to the soils. We're trying to build up the carbon in the soil.
I've got a product for you. I've got a product for you that I'm going to speak to you about. It's a byproduct of a mine, a garnet mine.
Okay.
I'll speak to you about it when we're not boring the people and thing, get too technical about it all. I'll tell you about it. It's interesting. It's a product they're using in the Middle East to turn sand into soil.
Oh, wow. That's probably a little bit like biochar or something.
It is biochar.
Yeah.
biotite. It's a byproduct.
Okay. Yeah. Mm. So the regenerative agriculture for me is something which we've seen this coming through more recently, but it's something that's been practiced for so long. And as someone like Johan Reinecke, obviously, is a specialist in organics and biodynamics, and those are words we know, but there's elements in those that I like and elements I don't like. But in the end of the day, if we feed our soil correctly, a vine, we only see half of the vineyard above the ground. And so much is in the soil.
Absolutely.
And it's about being able to take those soils, preserve them for the next generation, improve them, build that carbon matter. And over the last 60 years, we've had farming practices that have just depleted carbon.
Well, the other thing is that I'm a great proponent of the fact that the planet is much bigger than us.
Mm.
It's much more intelligent than us. The universe does really know best. This is where we get deep on Kerry's Connoisseurs.
Yeah.
And whilst I am of the opinion, I agree with you that we need to replenish soils. The planet does that by itself. The problem is that there's too many people. So we've got too many people farming this planet. We need to move to a different place. But the climate is not always completely conducive to that which you would like to be farming. So if we want to stay in the Western Cape and we want to continue to farm grapes, we need to find whatever it is to put back into that soil, which is exactly what people like yourself are doing and modern-day farmers are doing. I mean, my generation, the guys were a little bit sort of lost corp about it. They didn't put too much back into the soil.
There's also a knowledge base around, and I think what we know today in terms of how to sequestrate carbon and build up the soils and the French understand this because in France you'd only own the property.
Built on a marsh.
Yeah, but you only own your property for 100 years and you've got to hand it over and you've got to repay taxes. So for them, you are a steward of the land. You are there for a period of time and then you hand it over. That's how they operate in Burgundy. Mm. And it's so important to make sure that what you hand over is better than what you received. Mm. And that is really where a lot of our viticulture is busy going towards and moving. And it'll be great for water retention. I think the quality of fruit will improve. Mm. And it's something I'm really excited about to see where that's going to move in the future.
And is there a new little Larish that I need to know about who's going to be a ewe?
There's two little ones. Well, there's one already. He's 2.5. Lucas was a 21 baby. So he's
lucky
got a
Lucas.
Very,
he's got a
very
nice
lucky
vintage.
He's got a couple of magnums.
So my child had an 85 vintage, which was very nice. I bought him some Angelus Magnums for his 85 vintage.
Ooh, lovely.
And when he got big, I sold him and bought him a townhouse.
It's also a good investment.
It is. It's the best thing to do.
So my dad's two vintages were 82 and 84, which were two of his best. And mine have now been 2021 and 2024. I'm expecting my second son in August.
And I must say, you and I chatted briefly yesterday, but I think that 2017, and I don't know about your 2019. I can't remember if I've tasted 2019 from you, but I like some 2019s that I've tasted. Mm. 17 and 19. Everybody shouted from the rooftops about 2015. Mm. And I've tasted some shit wine from 2015. I have. It was hailed as one of the best vintages in, you know, the Western Cape for a long time. I think 2017 and some of the 2019s and definitely that 21 of yours.
Mm.
So it looks like it's all odd numbers.
For now, 24, I got all my analysis back yesterday, so I've been very excited, and that was kind of my last little cherry on top.
Is 24 good?
I've got some amazing wines in the cellar.
Have you?
So I'm really excited to see what 24 is going to deliver as well. We've had a run of spectacular vintages from 2015. 15 was tricky, and I think there's a lot of wines that went too far, too ripe, too big.
Mm.
But
I don't
those
think
that
they're
going to
last.
But those that are good are going to be spectacular.
Very good.
I mean,
I mean,
I agree with Tim that the Pearl Sour 2015 is a spectacular wine. But what I saw 15s do is they just shut down completely. From the vintages I've watched develop, from about 4 years old to now 9 years old, those 15s just disappeared on us. And now they're starting
come
to
back.
Open up. They are those that I've tasted have come back. Our reserve went completely closed, and now it's starting to show again. So you definitely saw, for some reason, that vintage just shut down very tightly.
So do we think that, well, it's too early to tell that Lucas, even with his good vintage. How are we going to coerce him into taking over as the third generation winemaking?
Well, some of my dad convinced my sister and I to do it. So
yes,
hopefully I'll be able to do the same. I guess if you give him a couple of nice bottles of wine to drink as he's
growing
up,
that
usually helps.
I think he's got occultish powers, your father. Like I say, he's a great cabernet whisperer.
Mm.
And he clearly has a large influence over his children, too.
No, definitely.
You do as you're told.
luckily, we get along really well.
In his quiet way, he's the most gorgeous man. I love your father. And he's been such an asset to the wine industry in South Africa. He really has. While we're talking about him, do you still have your property in France that you...
Oh, no. So that actually ended in 2006 already.
Oh, did it?
So that was only a four-year stint.
Richesse doesn't come from there.
So the Richesse name comes from there.
Yes, but I thought you were swapping grapes or juice or something.
No, not at all. Basically, what happened there was that it was a Joburg couple who we had partnered with and they'd opened the winery there. And they'd made a lot of their own wines, and then they quickly realized that making wine is much easier than selling wine. So when I was working at Angelus in 2009... we went to visit them, and I was sleeping in tank 6, and my dad was sleeping in tank 9. They turned the winery into a house, and they're now into property development and restoring old properties through the Entre de Mer in
France.
Probably
a whole lot more.
Yeah, and they're still
lucrative.
They're still drinking the wines that they made. So that very quickly
the
dream changed.
Yes.
Exactly. So we only did 3 vintages of that.
Okay.
I've always been playing with the idea of doing something again, but
you should.
Maybe when the time comes, I'll start a venture somewhere. But at the moment, I've got too much to do in Stellenbosch, so it's not on the near future, but definitely in the long-term dream.
And is your sister married with babies?
Yes, she's got 2, Emma and Lex. I think they're 26. 16 and 18 vintage, yeah. So they're now 7 and 9, yeah. So she's got 2 little kids as well. She's living on the farm as well with her husband, so they...
And is he involved in the business?
No, my brother-in-law's not in the business and my wife is not in the business, and we keep them very far separated from everything.
Yeah, keep them far away, otherwise you'll be divorced very soon.
No, they've got their own careers and their own directions. My brother-in-law trades commodities, and my wife is a...
Somebody's got to make
agent.
Money.
Yeah, no, exactly. So they're definitely doing a little bit better than we are.
I was about to ask you... Oh, I know what I was going to ask you. If I said to you, you've got 1 shot at your death row meal and drink, what is it?
Oh, wow.
Death row, hey? It's the last one. What's it going to be?
It's a tough one. My wife was asking me this other day. Honestly, a good lamb loin chop, properly done in the braai, is always going to be
what do you put on it?
One of
you
my
just,
favorites.
Just salt and pepper.
Salt, pepper, a little bit of lemon. You don't need anything else if it's good quality meat from the Karoo. There will probably be broccoli and white sauce. It's been one of my favorites since I was about 4 years old.
Okay.
Some lovely roast potatoes. And then from a wine point of view, it's going to depend on what I feel like on the day. There's so many.
But if now I know that there's a whole lot of people who are going to listen to this and they're going to say, let's make Christo's death row meal for dinner tonight. So we have to give them a wine to taste with it.
If I look at some of the standout wines I've had in my life, there's quite a few of the Bordeaux, lovely, beautiful old Bordeaux.
We love them.
I'm a big fan of Piemonte and the Nebbiolos come out of there. Bordeaux white.
We love Bordeaux wine.
Spectacular.
It's so expensive, though. We can't afford it.
It's super expensive, but it's just, I mean, once those wines age, they are unbelievable.
Yeah.
I've had a couple of beautiful old Stellenbosch wines, 82 Rustenburg Superior.
82 was a fabulous vintage, hey?
Honestly, actually, if I could probably think of a wine to drink on my death row, it would be 82 Rustenburg Superior and Magnum. My dad opened a bottle the other day with a tasting. And I had the wine the next morning.
It was still delicious.
With only so much in the bottle left over. And it was still singing. So it's just that wine just is, it's an occultish wine in this country.
Yeah, it is.
It's spectacular. I don't know how many bottles Artie Bardenhorst ran away with when he left Rustenburg, but apparently he's still got a big stash of it.
I'm sure he did.
But it really has been one of my kind of benchmark wines where I do want to see our wines moving towards.
Mm.
Well, we're already in that lineup.
You're definitely
there's this romance around that wine. It was my sister's birth year as well. But yeah, let's say that I think the 82 Rustenburg Superior.
And a lamb chop.
And a
broccoli
lamb chop.
And white sauce. Roasty potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds good enough to me for a death row meal.
Exactly. And that's Lucas's favorite meal as well at the moment. So that'll definitely work well together.
Done.
Yeah.
Christo, thank you for coming, my darling child.
Ah, it's a pleasure.
It was lovely to chat to you. And thank you for treating me yesterday to your absolutely delicious wines. If you do nothing else this year, I keep saying that because I tasted some of Nick's wines from Oldenburg the other day. Gosh, they're just so delicious as well. There is such beautiful wine out there at the moment. And I find them all, and they all come and talk to me. So listen and go and do as I say. Go and find yourself some Le Riche. If you can't find the reserve, just buy the Cabernet.
Definitely. There's still some 21 Cab on the shelves.
The 21 Cabernet is delicious. Just have some. And if you don't want red wine, the Chardonnay is also jolly delicious.
It is, but you're not going to find it on a shelf.
Aren't we?
No, it's
only available at your cellar door.
Cellar door only. It's one of those that hardly anybody knows about. Yeah.
Jump online and see if you can find somebody at the cellar door. But you really do need to start entertaining yourself to some Le Riche wines. Thank you, my darling.
Thanks,
absolutely triumphant wine. Thank you. Cheers.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.